Was there an Adam? Was there an Eve? Or did we evolve from what we conceived? Either way, we got what we needed when the sun shone down on the Garden of Eden.
Don't you know we're gonna have a Solartopia, Solartopia, Solartopia. Don't you know we're gonna have a Solartopia all over God's green world?
Well, we bit that apple and the garden was lost, and so we had to work to pay the cost. And so we went digging into the ground and started to burn many things we found.
Yes, we did. We started to burn many things we found. This is Harvey Wasserman back with the Solartopia Green Power and Wellness Show for another hour of exciting fun and world catastrophe. We're talking with Kevin Camps. Kevin, you're there, buddy. Kevin.
Yeah, hello,
Camps,
I'm here.
Are you with us?
Yes.
All right. Good, good, good. Where are you, Kevin?
I'm in Monroe, Michigan, and greetings to you from Arne Gundersen and Michael Keegan. We are here to battle the proposed new reactor at Fermi 3.
Yeah, that thing's never going to get built. You guys are going to kill it. Kevin Camps is one of our great experts on nuclear power and has been fighting the industry for God knows how. You tell us, Kevin, how long have you been fighting nuclear power?
Well, you gave a talk in Kalamazoo, Michigan, my hometown, in March of 93, and I've been fighting it ever since, because you moved me to devote my life to this subject.
Oh, my God. I'm responsible. So I'm the bad guy now.
You're to blame. You're to blame.
Was that 1993 or 1893?
Yeah, right.
Okay. Well, Kevin, you're a good, young-looking guy, and you've been around. You're very, very bright, and you've been with us forever. I want to start talking. You're with Arne Gundersen?
Yeah, he's our expert witness on quality assurance or lack thereof at the proposed new Fermi 3 reactor here in Monroe, Michigan.
Well, that's great. I'm really honored to have you, and I'm honored that you're going to be with us for this half hour. Going to have you on until 3:30 Eastern time, and I'm going to be joined by Dr. Murray Susser. Who has a lot to tell us about Lyme disease and other stuff with the human body. Kevin, let's run through it here. Why are you opposing the Fermi unit? There have been three units at Fermi in Michigan, and we'll talk to this, but I want to segue into Fukushima in a minute. Yeah. But there are three units, Fermi units in Monroe, Michigan, which is 35 miles south of Detroit and about 35 or 40 east of Ann Arbor, which is more relevant to me since I went to the University of Michigan. What is it you're doing with Fermi, and what's the big deal? Tell us why you're there and what you're opposing.
Well, there's only a small number of proposed new reactors left afloat in the United States. You got the two in Georgia that are under construction. You got the two in South Carolina under construction. Most of the rest, and there were some three dozen proposed, have been canceled or postponed indefinitely. But this Fermi Unit 3 is limping along. They're trying to get a license. And, you know, this is the same location as the Fermi 1 meltdown of 1966. We almost lost Detroit. In fact, Fermi 3 would be built right on top of the Fermi 1 site.
Oh, my God. They're going to put it right on top of the old site?
They've had to dismantle what was left, and there was a lot left of Fermi 1. It's been under decommissioning since 1972. They've had accidents out at Fermi 1, despite the plant being shut down for, you know, 40 years, 41 years. They had a 8,000-gallon tritium release a couple years ago. They had a sodium fire out there. So, yeah, they're going to build Fermi 3 right on top of Fermi 1. But Fermi 2, which has been operating since 1988, is the biggest Fukushima twin in the world. It's a General Electric Mark 1 boiling water reactor. It's as big in size as Fukushima Daiichi Units 1 and 2 put together. So if they were to build Fermi 3, what you'd have is the old Fermi 2 age-degraded reactor risks, and then we've all seen what that can look like on live television at Fukushima Daiichi, and then you'd have the break-in phase, so-called break-in phase risks with Fermi 3. And remember, Three Mile Island and Fermi 1 and Chernobyl, those were brand-new reactors that had, you know, catastrophic accidents. So you'd have the break-in phase of the new reactor, and you'd have the breakdown phase of the old reactor. That's a lot of risk on one site.
Yeah, and tell us, you know, we're in the middle of dealing with Fukushima. Tell us what happened, just to revive us and remind us. Tell us what happened at Fermi Unit 1 in October of 1966.
Well, this was a plutonium breeder reactor, experimental in design, and weapons-grade plutonium was the original reason they wanted to build it. They wanted to sell weapons-grade plutonium to the U.S. nuclear arsenal, and then Eisenhower gave his Atoms for Peace speech, and they couldn't get away with that anymore. So then it was all about electricity now. What happened at Fermi 1 on October 5th, 1966, was a retrofitted piece of hardware in the reactor core came loose. It was kind of a conical-shaped piece of metal that was supposed to disperse the melted down core if they were to have a meltdown, so it couldn't form a critical mass in the bottom of the reactor. And this conical piece of metal came loose under the high pressures of the liquid sodium coolant flowing through the core, and it blocked two of the fuel channels, and you actually had two irradiated nuclear fuel assemblies melt down in the Fermi 1 core. And the reason that John Fuller chose that title, We Almost Lost Detroit, for his 1975 book, was they were on the precipice of a much larger scale meltdown in that core, and they didn't know whether to intervene or not intervene, which would be worse. And being engineers, they decided to intervene, and fortunately, we did not lose Detroit, but we came very close.
Well, we've lost it since, but not because of Fermi.
Financial meltdown, yeah.
So tell us what could have happened in a worst-case scenario had the accident proceeded at Fermi. And folks listening in, I hope this will be instructive, because we're going to segue from this discussion into Three Mile Island, Chernobyl, and then what's happening at Fukushima. This was the first real close call, I'd say, with a huge catastrophic nuclear catastrophe from the nuclear power industry. And Kevin, you being a Michigander, a native of Kalamazoo, you know all about this, so fill us in.
Well, John Fuller, if people haven't read We Almost Lost Detroit, it's such a great read. He documents that Ed Teller, of all people, the father of the hydrogen bomb, served on the Advisory Committee on Reactor Safeguards at the time. And that Advisory Committee on Reactor Safeguards warned the Atomic Energy Commission, this Fermi 1 design is too risky, it's too dangerous, don't build this thing. The Atomic Energy Commission overruled its own advisory board, and also, unfortunately, the United Auto Workers under Walter Reuther lost in court. It went all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court, and by a 7-2 ruling, the Atomic Energy Commission prevailed, where it set the precedent that really the Atomic Energy Commission, now the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, has carte blanche over radiological safety issues. No matter how messed up their decision-making is, they have carte blanche over radiological safety, and nobody can touch it. And the reason the United Auto Workers filed that lawsuit is they had 500,000 union members within a 50-mile radius of Fermi Unit 1. So that happened a couple, 3 years before the meltdown. So, you know, the meltdown kind of showed that all those critics, all those skeptics knew what they were talking about. And we almost lost Detroit because this experimental plutonium breeder reactor, that melted down core had so much plutonium in it that it was not beyond the realm of possibility that you could have had, the word choice is interesting, a small-scale plutonium explosion, like a nuclear weapon explosion. But even a small-scale plutonium explosion is a large-scale explosion. And that's why United Auto Workers was worried about 500,000 of its members, even out to distances 50 miles away, being injured or killed by such a scenario.
How many people would have been injured and killed?
Just 500,000 UAW workers to begin with, but we're talking many millions of people. I mean, Detroit was a boom town at the time. You know, you had millions of people within just a 50-mile radius, and if you had a plutonium explosion at a, you know, breeder reactor, that would have created a fallout cloud that extended long distances. I mean, Chernobyl itself, there are hot spots thousands of miles away from Chernobyl, places like Scotland, you know, that are still contaminated with radioactive cesium some 27 years later.
So what would an explosion at Fermi 1 in 1966 have done to the Great Lakes?
Well, certainly the fallout airborne would have settled on the Great Lakes, and that would have been large-scale radioactive contamination. But, you know, Monroe, Michigan, the Fermi site is right on the edge of Lake Erie. So you would have had a liquid discharge into the lakes that would have, you know, extended all the way downstream into Lake Ontario, where you've got cities like, you know, Cleveland, you've got Toronto. We're talking tens of millions of people draw their drinking water from just Lake Erie and Ontario. So, you know, what we're seeing at Fukushima Daiichi with these unprecedented discharges into the ocean, just imagine something like that happening on the Great Lakes.
God, I don't think I want to. So how did it happen? They did intervene and they stopped the catastrophe at Fermi 1. But the site, the reactor, of course, was ruined. Then, geniuses that they are, they revived the reactor for a short period of time. They spent tons and tons of money. Is that right? Did they reopen Fermi 1?
They were so stubborn and so in la-la land that they reopened it after the 66 meltdown. They limped along and hardly generated any electricity at all. But like you said, spending god-awful amounts of money. And finally called her quits in 1972. And it's been a decommissioning project ever since with those recent accidents I mentioned. They shipped the melted-down fuel assemblies out to Idaho for what they call temporary storage. And, you know, temporary already has been 40 years, and it's looking like it's going to be decades or centuries longer.
God. All right, then we had Three Mile High, and then we had Chernobyl. Let's talk now about Fukushima, Kevin, because we only got 17 minutes to do that.
Okay.
What is happening now? You're with Arne Gundersen, who's been the great wellspring of information about Fukushima. And I want to tell our listeners and you that the Japanese government is about to clamp down with a state secrets act that's going to make it virtually impossible to get information from Fukushima. I mean, they're going to make it a crime to in Japan to speak about things that harm the so-called national security. I mean, we've talked for 40 years about how nuclear power and democracy cannot coexist, and here we see Fukushima about to call an end to democracy in Japan. But given what we know now, and you're with Arne Gundersen, Kevin Camps, tell us what's happening at Fukushima and what we need to watch for.
Well, the latest headlines for months now have been about the radioactive water leaks into the ocean. So they've just had like a Keystone Cops comedy, only it's not funny at all, going on with lots of human air, which kind of stands to reason because they are burning through so many thousands of workers that they're actually now, as of today, they're talking about bringing in Tokyo Electric Power Company workers from their hydro division, so those are dams, and their coal plant division to work on the Fukushima Daiichi site because they've exposed so many workers, including subcontractors who aren't even TEPCO employees, to their maximum allowable radiation limits that they can't work there anymore. So they're bringing in inexperienced people, and the list of leaks that have happened are just many. I mean, you've had a 300-ton, which is 72,000-gallon leak of highly radioactive water just from a bad storage tank at the site, because a lot of this cooling water on the melted-down cores and radioactively contaminated water from the groundwater flow into the basements of Fukushima Daiichi, they're putting into this tank farm. What they can catch, there's another, you know, 72,000 gallons per day of radioactive groundwater flowing into the ocean. But this leak back in August that they admitted to was 300 tons, 72,000 gallons of highly radioactive water that just leaked into the ground and then flowed out into the ocean. And that got a lot of attention. And since that time, you have had workers overfilling storage tanks. So there went highly radioactive water into the ground and into the ocean. You've had the typhoons hitting one after another. And there's so much contamination around this storage tank farm that that's a problem. And so they were racing to try to deal with this growing level of rainwater, which then overflowed its containment and also hit the ground and went out into the ocean. So you've just had one leak after another, and it's caused so many black eyes that when you bring up this new secrecy law, I think they're tired of all the international attention they're getting on these leaks.
Yes, and as you know, Kevin Camps, by the way, is with Beyond Nuclear. What is your website, Kevin?
It's www.beyondnuclear.org.
Okay, beyondnuclear.org. And your official title is a chief potentate, is that correct?
Radioactive waste watchdog.
All right. Well, you look nothing like any dogs I've ever seen, but the fact is that I've posted at nukefree.org, and as you know, Kevin, we're circulating a petition calling for a global takeover of Fukushima, and of course the Japanese government is clearly headed in exactly the opposite direction. They've got the Olympics coming up. They don't want the world to know what's going on there. But on the other hand, this is a supremely dangerous situation. And the petition is at www.nukefree.org. Nukefree.org. We're over 104,000 signatures. We will be delivering them to the United Nations on November 7th, which is the day before TEPCO says they're going to start removing fuel rods from Unit 4 at Fukushima. I doubt that they're going to be ready to do it at that time, but that's what they've announced. And it's also the day that CNN is going to air this ridiculous pro-nuclear disinfomercial called Pandora's Promise. And we're going to actually make combined demonstrations in New York and go from the United Nations to CNN. We'll see about that. Kevin, what more can you tell us about what's happening at Fukushima in addition to the labor crisis? And by the way, Reuters ran a very strong piece, which I'm sure you've seen, about organized crime involvement in the use of workers at Fukushima, and it's a nightmare story. It's also posted, linked at nukefree.org. Have you been working on that part of the issue at all, Kevin?
Yeah, we just had a panel at PowerShift, the youth climate gathering, which was in Pittsburgh just a week or so ago. We had a speaker named Yuko Tonohira from Todos Somos Japan, and she's a great anti-nuclear activist and graphic artist, and she was the first one I ever heard that story about the Yakuza, the Japanese mafia, being so prevalent at the Fukushima Daiichi site in terms of recruiting workers and, you know, pocketing most of the money. They'd find people who were in debt to the mafia or just down and out, and those workers would be barely making minimum wage and getting exposed to, you know, high levels of radioactivity. And she brought that to my attention at an event in New York City back in December of 2011. So it's really great that, you know, that Reuters is now getting that out there more widely. You mentioned the Fukushima Daiichi Unit 4 high-level radioactive waste emergency removal from the storage pool. That Unit 4 was so devastated by the explosion in March of 2011 that the infrastructure was destroyed and the crane was destroyed. And so they've spent this whole time ever since, 2.5 years, rebuilding the infrastructure on Unit 4 to support the crane, to support these 100-ton loads, which is 90 tons of radiation shielding and 10 tons of high-level radioactive waste in the center, to get that waste out of the pool, some 200 tons of waste in the pool, before that building collapses. And, you know, just a few days ago, they had another 7.3 earthquake just off the Fukushima coastline. And then you've got the radioactive groundwater flood, I'll call it, because they've built an underground wall to try to stop the flow into the ocean. But what that accomplished was piling the groundwater up behind the dam, the underground dam, making the liquefaction risk all the greater. Liquefaction is when solid earth behaves more like a liquid than a solid. And that's what they have going on at the site at this point. If that building were to collapse and the cooling water were to be lost from the storage pool, those 200 tons of high-level waste could quickly catch on fire, and it would dwarf what's happened so far at Fukushima Daiichi, if you can imagine that, because there's no radiological containment over that pool whatsoever. At least the units 1, 2, and 3 meltdowns, although in damaged or destroyed containment structures, at least there were containment structures, you know. But on the pool, there's no containment. We're talking orders of magnitude more radioactivity release into the environment if that stuff catches on fire. They have to get it out, you know. That's going to be risky enough. They cannot drop one of these things, which is one of the risks. If they drop one of these 100-ton loads and it crashes through the floor and drains the water that way, then we're in the same boat. So, you know, the General Electric shareholders meeting was in Detroit in April of 2012, and Pat Burney from GE Stockholders Alliance tapped me and Michael Keegan to speak on behalf of their group. And I got 5 seconds with Jeffrey Immelt, the CEO of General Electric, before the meeting began, and I begged him at the time for GE to involve itself in this fuel removal. It's their reactor design, after all. And he just shrugged his shoulders at me. So congratulations to you, Harvey, on the petition. Senator Wyden from Oregon has, for a year and a half, been calling for the U.S. government at the highest levels in the military, Department of Energy, Nuclear Regulatory Commission, to involve itself with its full resources to help the Japanese at Fukushima Daiichi.
Well, God knows they need help, and we need help. I mean, how many fuel assemblies are there in the fuel pool at Unit 4? I've read there are about 1,500 and some fuel rods. How many assemblies is that?
I don't know the count.
Okay.
I'm more familiar.
You might want to ask Arnie.
And
Gunderson has been warning us about, you know, this removal. I guess they have to remove the rods one by one from the fuel assemblies at Fukushima Unit 4. Is that right?
That I don't know either. I heard a spokeswoman from the Japanese parliament when they did that special investigation. She spoke at Helen Caldicott's event in New York City last March, and she put the figure at 200 tons of fuel in that pool. So that's one figure I have, but I don't know how it breaks down in terms of assemblies or rods.
Okay, so the point is that beginning November 8th, at least that's what Tokyo Electric Power says, they're going to try and pull these rods out. Now, those rods are probably embrittled, crumbling, bent, warped. You know, they did catch fire at one point, as I recall, Kevin. In fact, we have an IAEA, a letter from the International Atomic Energy Agency saying there was a fire, that radiation was released. God knows what kind of shape those fuel rods are in.
Yeah. You know, what's crazy is the official version of what has happened at Fukushima Daiichi Unit 4 alone is still very obscure. And so the official version now is that there was no fire in the pool. They're trying to claim that. Nuclear Energy Institute is, you know, smugly pointing out that the official version says no fire. I think the jury's still out. I actually heard a Department of Energy spokesman. He was one of the top three people at DOE. He was testifying before the NRC Advisory Committee on Reactor Safeguards about Fukushima. It was May 26th of 2011, and already they were backpedaling, saying no fire. But he pointed out that a section of the pool, there are walls in these pools, could have caught fire. So perhaps a section of the pool. And, you know, it was that fear that the pool was without cooling water that led the U.S. government at the highest levels, President Obama, Secretary of State Clinton, NRC Chairman Yasko, to declare a 50-mile evacuation of Americans from Fukushima Daiichi. The Japanese did not match that. They only went out to 12.4 miles. So that was for fear of a pool fire at that time. So I think the jury's still out. There's still the possibility that there was a fire, and they're just trying to keep that quiet.
Well, we have posted at nuclear.org a letter from the International Atomic Energy Agency saying that there was a fire. You might want to take a look at that and show it to Arnie Gunderson for your full evaluation, because I don't know where it came from, but it's up there. I presume it came from the IAEA, where else could it have come from? But they did pour seawater in there, as I recall, and of course seawater is massively corrosive. It's been 2.5 years now. I wonder what damage has been done to the structure and the assemblies and all that stuff by that seawater.
Reminiscent of Chernobyl, there were water drops by helicopter in Japan, and that was all about the pools they were trying to drop, and it was seawater. They picked up seawater in giant buckets and tried dropping it on the pools because they feared that the pools were devoid of cooling water. So that's why, you know, I think there's still a lot of information, including on where are the melted down reactor cores. We don't even know that, you know, the very basic questions about that site.
Right, they'll probably turn up in Indonesia. We're talking to Kevin Camps, radioactive waste watchdog from the Beyond Nuclear organization. BeyondNuclear.org is the website, www. Kevin has been with the anti-nuclear movement since 1993, a mere 20 years, but definitely got his feet wet. He's one of the stalwarts of the industry and now of the anti-nuclear campaign. And now you're in Monroe, Michigan. The only city in the United States with a statue honoring George Armstrong Custer, my favorite. And you're fighting the Fermi 2 and I presume Fermi 3 reactors. So how are you doing there? What's the status of your campaign? You got about 5 minutes to go. Four.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Well, we are before a kangaroo court. It's called the NRC Atomic Safety and Licensing Board, which has never denied a license in its history, as far as I know. And they have whittled down our contentions against this reactor. We had some three dozen over the course of the last 5 years. They've gotten rid of as many as they could, but there are a handful now that they still have before them. One is on quality assurance, and Arne Gunderson is our expert witness. For a long series of years, 2007 to 2009, they had no quality assurance. During the time of very important decision-making and design formulation on the blueprints, so that's a really important area that we're going to bring up before the Atomic Safety and Licensing Board in the next several days. Another issue that still stands is the eastern fox snake, which is an indigenous constrictor that's on the state threatened species list. This is going to be the biggest impact on coastal Great Lakes wetlands in the history of applicable environmental protection laws in the state of Michigan. That's according to the state. And the coastal wetlands is the habitat for the eastern fox snake. And they have not even looked at the ecological impacts on building 30 additional miles of transmission line corridor through forested wetlands, which is also eastern fox snake territory. And I should hasten to add that there are many species on the endangered list that this project would harm. The only one the hearing board
including
wants
human
to
beings.
About. Yeah, yeah. And,
go ahead.
You know,
So you're making all these contentions and contentions in front of the Atomic Safety and Licensing Board, but they tend to turn a deaf ear to people who come from the actual community, and they basically do what the industry tells it to do. Or is that an oversimplification?
Well, one that they can't just dismiss with their rubber stamp for industry is the high-level radioactive waste issue, because a coalition of environmental groups and states last year won a major court ruling against the NRC's nuclear waste confidence decision, which we call a con game. And that is delaying the finalization of not only the Fermi 3 license, but also any other license extension at an old reactor or new license in the country. So we're fighting hard to load the official court record on that. And if they keep misbehaving, because they're racing through the environmental impact statement on the nuclear waste con game, they're going to land themselves back in federal court on this issue. And that could block licenses. That could block the generation of this forever deadly poison.
Well, Kevin, we really applaud your great work on this 20 years now. And, you know, the idea that anybody would seriously talk about building new nuclear plants with the ongoing catastrophe of Fukushima so far from resolved is mind-boggling to me, but we live in a strange universe, and the nuclear industry has way too much money and nothing else to do. Kevin Camps of BeyondNuclear.org, a last word for us real quick.
It's been a good year. We've shut down six reactors, old reactors in North America, and most of the proposed new ones have been canceled or postponed. So we just got to keep it up, and this industry is on a death path. Let's just not let them take us down with them.
All right, well, name those six as you go out. We love to hear the names of shut reactors.
Oh, Vermont Yankee, San Onofre 2 and 3, Crystal River in Florida, Kewaunee in Wisconsin, and Gentilly 2 in Quebec.
All right, great work, Kevin Camps. Thank you for preventing all those Fukushimas. We'll have you back on the show. Give our best to Mike Keegan and Arne Gunter. Arne Gunderson, and we'll be talking to you again. We're going to take a break now. When we come back, Dr. Murray Susser with some amazing information about Lyme disease and other key and important medical issues that you won't want to miss. Stay with us at the Solartopia Green Power and Wellness Show, and go visit Kevin Camps at BeyondNuclear.org.
Pipelines, mega dams, Iran, Iraq, Russia, Nigeria, Venezuela, Kurdistan, oil spill, meltdown, flooding, suburbia, mudslide, traffic jam, road rage, asthma, famine, leukemia, it's time to get a better plan. So
sweet home to me.
Yes, indeed. Lots of forest for the bears. That's my buddy Dana Lyon singing the Solartopia Green Power and Wellness song here, the Rocky Top version. We're back for another half hour, an important scintillating half hour, I hope, and I'm sure, with Dr. Murray Susser. Dr. Susser, you have a really impressive resume. Are you with us now?
Hello. Hello, Harvey. How are you?
I'm great. How are you? Out there in California?
I'm in California. I'm in West L.A.
West L.A., all right, good for you. You are a lot safer because of things we've talked about on this show, especially the shutdown of the San Onofre Nuclear Power Units 2 and 3, which we have won within the last few months. So congratulations on that.
Good,
and
you
have come to us through the great Eileen Proctor, and I'm honored to have you on the show.
Thank
and
you.
She has told me a bit about you, but I always hesitate to introduce people of your stature. So tell us a bit about yourself, please, and specifically your work on Lyme disease, which we want to talk about in detail because it's such an important issue and so, has harmed so many people. So, Dr. Susser, and also give us your website. Start with that. What is your website, Dr. Susser?
MurraySusserMD.com.
MurraySusserMD.com.
Yeah.
And where do you work? What are your credentials to tell us about Lyme disease?
Okay,
well,
I have
and
an
other
office
like
with
that.
Dr. Leroy Perry in West L.A. I've been an MD since 1966, so that gives you some idea. Before that, I was at drama school, and then I was a fighter pilot in the Air Force, flying all-weather interceptors for.
So you were you played Tom Cruise in Top Gun, is that correct?
Exactly. Yeah, I love that.
Okay.
He was almost as good a pilot as I was.
Yeah. What kind of planes did you fly, for God's sakes?
I flew jet fighters. I flew the F-86D and then that was replaced by the F-102A. They were both marvelous old airplanes, and they were wonderful to fly. And it was a wonderful experience in my life. It taught me a lot, and it gave me a lot of fun. It beat Disneyland by a ton.
Well, did you shoot at anybody from these airplanes?
Never in anger.
Oh, you mean you shot at people you liked?
Yeah, we just had target practice. B-29 would tow a sleeve that was like that was our target, and we'd fire. The F-86 had 2.75-inch Mighty Mouse rockets, and we fired salvos of 24 of those, and that would take an airplane out of the sky. And then we had the Falcon missiles. The F-102 carries 6 Falcon missiles, they were either heat-seeking or radar-seeking. And my job, I was stationed in northern Vermont near Ethan Allen Air Force Base, at Ethan Allen Air Force Base and near Burlington, Vermont. And my job was to be one of the guys who would shoot down any Russian bombers who came over here. And
Russian bombers. I thought in northern Vermont you'd be protecting us from those pesky Canadians.
That's right. The Canadians and maybe renegade Mexicans, too. I don't know.
You were responsible for protecting us for an invasion
of
Canadian terrorists. Is that right?
The Russian bombers, if they would be coming, they come in the Great Circle route, so they come over the North Pole and then head straight south through New England. And my job was to protect New York and Philadelphia and Washington, of course. And that was the hottest part of the Cold War. It was after Korea and before Vietnam, but the Cold War was really scary for everybody. That's when people were building bomb shelters, fallout shelters, and everybody was scared that there could be a nuclear holocaust any moment. And we had, quite a few narrow escapes, the Kennedy thing and several others like that.
You mean the Cuban Missile Crisis?
The Cuban Missile Crisis, exactly.
Were you flying one of these planes during the Cuban Missile Crisis?
Not really, no. I wasn't anywhere near them, you know. That was before the Cuban Missile Crisis. I was in the Air Force before Kennedy was president. Eisenhower was president when I was in.
Wow. God, you know, this, when I brought you on the show, this is the last thing on earth I thought we'd be talking about is fighting fire, and we could do this for another hour or two, but we better get to Lyme disease.
So Lyme disease is more important for each individual now at the moment. If this nuclear stuff that you were just talking about gets worse, we could be in deep trouble from that for sure.
Well, we are definitely in deep trouble, and what's really disturbing now is that the Japanese are moving towards a state secrets act. We're not going to know anything that's going on there. That is really disturbing. Our petition, I hope you'll sign it, is at nukefree.org, asking that the Fukushima be taken over by a global force of scientists, engineers, national groups, and taken away from a private company and a national government that obviously wants it all kept secret. But, Doctor, tell us now, please, about the nature of your medical work.
What you're
offering to the public.
Okay. Well, many years ago, when I was first practicing medicine, I got interested in hypoglycemia, which is low blood sugar, which comes from high-tech malnutrition, the kind of malnutrition that most of us are suffering from civilized diet. And that led on to a number of other diseases that slipped through the cracks of conventional medicine. No, most conventional doctors didn't believe in it then. They don't believe in it now, but it's an important factor in most of our lives and one of the reasons why we have to be good at eating wholesome diets and taking lots of good nutrients to supplement what we might be missing. I did chelation therapy, which I still do, intravenous chelating agents which bind heavy metals. And most of us are over-toxified with contaminants like lead, cadmium, mercury, arsenic. These are all in our environment, and some of us absorb it worse than others, and some of us are really highly toxified by it.
Let me interrupt you real quick. So if I came into your office in West Hollywood and you did an IV chelation on me, that would be like cleaning out the radiator or whatever. This chelation would take toxic metals out of my body? Is that
exactly
what you're saying?
Yeah, the chelation means metal binding, and in the medical parlance, we put the chelating agent into the vein. It hooks on preferentially to the toxic metals. It also takes some good metals out, like zinc, and calcium and magnesium, and you don't want to take those metals out if you could avoid it, but you can easily replace them with oral supplements. So that's part of the regime. We give oral supplements to go with the chelating agent, and then that led me on to a lot of other areas of medicine, particularly chronic fatigue syndrome. I wrote a book called Solving the Puzzle of Chronic Fatigue Syndrome. And that, with Dr. Michael Rosenbaum as co-author, and that has been very important because chronic fatigue is very important in Lyme disease. Chronic fatigue syndrome is defined by the Center for Disease Control in Atlanta as 50% or more debility for greater than 6 months with no known cause. That's the key right there. We get sick, and there's other things involved in chronic fatigue syndrome, like fevers and swollen glands and nerve disorders and skin disorders. All those things happen with chronic fatigue syndrome, but we don't know the cause. If we find the cause, like we find a chronic lung infection or a chronic prostate infection or a chronic ovarian infection or some kind of chronic infection, then it becomes chronic fatigue from that infection. In chronic fatigue syndrome, in my book, we talked about chronic fatigue. We talked about having chronic fatigue from some hidden infection, and what it turned out is it was commonly mixed infection. In those days, 25, 30 years ago, and before, it was always taught in medical school, and still is to a large extent, that you only get one infection at a time. Because you know when you're a kid, if you get mumps or measles or chickenpox, you never get another one at the same time. You don't get mumps and chickenpox at the same time because the body makes interferon, which keeps the virus from penetrating the cells, and the virus can't kill us if it's if it doesn't get in the cells. And so the childhood exanthems, the childhood viral diseases, never happen simultaneously. You never get two at a time. And they carried that principle out to every other infection. And it turns out that we do get mixed infections, and now they call it polymicrobial. They're starting to see or co-infections. So Lyme disease now, which is where I'm finally getting through this long maze of mine.
No, it's very interesting. Don't hold back, because these are critical things to know about. Dr. Murray Susser, go ahead. Tell us now about Lyme disease, please.
Okay, so Lyme disease is a tick-borne bacterial infection with a kind of bacteria called a spirochete. Looks like a corkscrew. It's in the same kind of bacterial family as syphilis and Borrelia and many other spirochetal diseases. But Borrelia is a nasty, nasty bug. The tick carries it, and it can carry two or three co-infections, so when the tick bites you and injects these bugs into your bloodstream, you can get two or three different infections, and this makes it all the more confusing and all the more difficult to treat. So Lyme disease, which was named after the town of Lyme, Connecticut, which is where the disease was discovered in 1975, and it should have been discovered much before that, because it was known in Europe in 1913. And so it's not a brand new disease, and there's some reports now. I don't know if you remember the snowman in the Alps, the 2,500-year-old snowman they found frozen.
Yeah.
Someone told me, there's on pretty good authority, that they found Lyme organisms in the joints of the snowman from 2,500 years ago.
Wow.
So
the question then is, what do we do about this?
Okay, the question is, how do we diagnose it? How do we treat it? And there's a big political football in that, which we may get to. But the point is that it is difficult to diagnose, because the testing is just now catching up to some extent with the difficult technology and the difficult biology of the bugs. The bug is very hard to test. It's very hard to see under a microscope. You have to use special stains. So the ordinary techniques don't work very well. Plus the fact that there are numerous subspecies. So with the Borrelia organism that I'm talking about is Borrelia burgdorferi, which is the most common one from Lyme, Connecticut, and that's a pathologic organism. It causes disease. The disease starts off as a skin disease, but it becomes a serious flu-like illness, which is much more serious than the flu, and it hits the different organs in the body. It hits the nervous system, it hits the joints, it hits the muscles. A lot of diseases from the nervous system and the muscle system and the bone system are misdiagnosed Lyme disease. I've had numerous people who were diagnosed with rheumatoid arthritis, even to the point of being crippled. When I tested them for Lyme, I found the Lyme disease, treated the Lyme disease, and their so-called rheumatoid arthritis got better, sometimes completely better.
All right, so how do you treat this then?
Well, unfortunately, you have to use antibiotics. These are bacterial organisms. They're very elusive. They're very tough. They evolve quickly. And you have to use at least one, sometimes two or even three antibiotics. Plus the fact that when you're killing all the normal bacteria along with the Lyme bacteria, you're also making a very hospitable terrain for Candida or other yeast infections. You wind up using a lot of antibiotics, which I don't really like to do, but I've tried so many non-antibiotic treatments with very little success. The non-antibiotic treatments are also important. You have to build the immune system. You have to build up the adrenal gland, and you have to build up the thymus gland, and you have to build the mineral system and keep the junk food out of the body. You have to build the immune system to the best of your ability, and then the antibiotics work much better.
Now, what do you use to build the immune system? What's your strategy?
Well, I have a product called called Primal Boost, and that is composed of several endocrine glands and immune system glands, like the adrenal gland and the thymus gland. Most people have heard of the adrenal. Not everybody has heard of the thymus, even though it's important. When we're born, the thymus gland which is located behind the sternum, behind the breastbone, is right next to the heart. And the thymus gland, when we're born, is the same size as the heart. And that's how important it is. It's the master control gland for the immune system, and it tells the immune system what white cells to make, whether B cells, T cells, TH1, TH2. There's a whole lot of designations. CD54, the natural killer cells. There's a number of these cells that each one is key to our health and key to fighting enemy invaders.
And so what do you think of a vegan diet, or what kind of diet do you recommend people?
Well, the most important thing in the diet vegan diets, I think, depending on your individual metabolism. There are people who do well on vegan. I think the majority of people do not. And it's kind of a trial and error with good observation to decide who does well. Someday the new genetic testing will say, oh yeah, this is a type 1 vegan, this is a type 3 meat eating diet, and you'll be able to tell from your genetics which is your best diet. Right now we can't do that, to my knowledge. Maybe someone somewhere is discovering that. But what I find is the important thing in diet is to stay away from junk. Sugar is probably the biggest offender.
And aspartame, the substitutes for sugar are also miserable.
Yeah, they may be worse. Aspartame and things of that nature are toxic. But sugar has formed something that most people have not heard of called AGES. That's a shortening for Advanced Glycosylated End Products. Glycosylated means sugar. So when you eat sugar refined form, which means it's that all the everything the sugar came with has been taken away. So if you eat sugar cane, the sugar in there is about 10%, and the rest of it is fiber and vitamins and good things. So we take that away and we eat the sugar. Same thing as beet sugar. Well, a lot of our sugar comes from beets, and it's about 10% of the beet plant. So that sugar is fine when it's in its natural state in the beets or in the sugar cane, but it's not fine when you take it away and put it in a teaspoon and put it in your coffee or put it in your cereal or put it or have a ton of it in your Danish pastry.
Do you put your patients through a regimen of getting rid of sugar from their diet to treat Lyme disease?
Yeah, absolutely. I have a basic therapeutic diet which takes away sugar, white flour, alcohol, caffeine, refined carbohydrates, and some starchy foods like potatoes and maybe even honey. Honey, which is a very good product in many ways, is sometimes not good for, I mentioned earlier in the show, hypoglycemia.
What about maple syrup?
Maple syrup, again, I think this depends on the overall health and situation of the person. Maple syrup is like honey in respect that it has good quality to it, has things that are good for you, and if you do it in moderation and you're not sick to begin with, then you'll probably be fine with it. Same thing is true of honey. But if you are sick and you want to do the optimal thing for your system and you want to keep away from anything that might disturb and weaken your immune system, then you stay away from honey and maple syrup and things of that nature.
Talking to Dr. Murray Susser of West Hollywood, California. Your website again, Dr. Susser?
Website is murraysussermd.com. Can I give my phone number?
Please.
My phone number in West L.A. is 310-479-8909.
Okay, and people with Lyme disease, do you get them coming to you for special treatment? And
yeah,
also, does this chelation therapy fit into treating Lyme disease?
Sometimes that helps help the Lyme by by cleaning out a lot of the toxic metals, which are in and of themselves suppress the immune system. I give intravenous vitamins, intravenous oxidative therapies. I give a lot of intravenous vitamin C, which is sometimes really miraculous.
How can you tell us about that? What would intravenous, well, give us some actual instances.
I have a patient now who came to me with a diagnosis of rheumatoid arthritis, going to one of the HMOs, and she was taking all sorts of drugs, and she was in constant pain. And I did a quick workup on it. Not a quick. I did my workup to begin the beginning workup, and we were going to an order test and all that. And we were just about to leave, and I said, "Oh, by the way, why don't we try a vitamin C intravenously on you?" And halfway through the vitamin C, which takes about an hour, hour and a half, she had this big smile on her face, and she said, "The pain in my arms is gone. I've had this agonizing pain in my forearms up to my elbows for months and months, and nothing takes it away, and it's gone now."
That's pretty amazing.
It was amazing. I do a lot of this, and you don't usually get that great a result. Get good results a lot, and it's not unusual to have two or three treatments and have it go away. But to have it go away halfway through the first treatment, and here's the best part: she's been my patient now for 2.5-3 months. The pain has never come back.
Well, how often, Dr. Marie Susser, we have about 5 minutes left. How often do you do intravenous treatments on your patients with Lyme disease and other similar ailments?
Well, depending on the circumstance. If someone has an acute ailment like a severe flu, I just might give one for one and that's it. Someone like this patient, I'm giving her one a week. And all sorts of things that have been bothering her are gradually getting better. And she's doing a lot of other things, but she doesn't have rheumatoid arthritis symptoms anymore.
Your chelation for detoxifying the body, how often is that, like something you do, like, you know, changing the antifreeze in your car? Is that a periodic treatment?
Yeah, I do it. I've had about probably 50 or 60 treatments in my life. I know doctors who do chelation who have had as many as 900 chelations in their life.
Well, how often do you do them?
It's very variable. If somebody is acutely ill and has vascular disease, it's been shown to be very good for vascular disease, by the way, then you might do it twice a week. Carlos Lamar, who half invented the original chelation, did it 5 days a week for 20 treatments. I think that's overkill because people get really tired from losing all the, from disturbing all the minerals. But once a week is a very good routine for many kinds of conditions. Now, I didn't mention vascular disease. You know, there's only so many things you can talk about in a half hour. But if you have vascular disease of the heart or the brain, chelation therapy has now been shown in a $31 million study financed by the National Institutes of Health. Now, this is not alternative medicine anymore. This is the National Institutes of Health, and the NIH, and they paid $31 million for this study, and they treated 1,700 people, half of them with chelation and half of them with a placebo. And they got remarkable results, surprised everybody, even surprised us a little bit, the chelation docs. But the American Heart Association docs and those guys who have been condemning chelation for 35 years, they kind of don't know what to say, because 17%, there's a 17% decrease in cardiac and stroke events in the people who got chelated. And better than that, the diabetics who got chelated had a 38% decrease in cardiac and stroke events. And that is stunning. And that is about as official as you can get. It's from the NIH.
That's amazing. Okay, Dr. Murray Susser, a couple of last words. We're just about out of time.
Well, the last words is breathe deeply whenever you can.
Well, it depends on where you are, though. I mean, you're in West LA. If you were in East LA, I don't know about breathing deeply, right?
Yeah. Well, even with that, even with the soot, if you wear a mask, it's better. No, but you know, pay attention, diet, exercise, and know that there are high-tech alternatives treatments like chelation and vitamin C and hydrogen peroxide. And things of that nature, they exist and they're powerful, and you have miraculous things. I have a young man, 20-some-year-old man, now sitting in my room, in my treatment room, getting intravenous oxidative therapy, and he was exposed to black mold. And black mold is, and he was really sick for a long time after that. I gave him one treatment last week, and today he came back about 50% improved already.
All right, well, Doctor, when I'm in L.A., next time I'm going to come see you. I'm going to get my oil changed and get one of those vitamin C things and just go back to playing tackle football like I used to when
okay,
I was a kid.
Okay.
Thank
I'll
you
I'll
so much, Dr. Murray
receiver.
Susser. Spell out the website real quick. Doctor
is
D-O-C-T-O-R.
Murray, M-U-R-R-A-Y, S-U-S-S-E-R, M-D, .com.
Very, very good. You've been a great guest. Thank you so much. Another hour of the Soiltopia Green Power Wellness Show has flown by.
My
next week we'll be back
you.
With more great stuff. We hope you're going to go with us and have a great week. Thanks so much.
Will we beat the